The title of this is You Could Die From That. So my objective is that when we're done, you'll be able to list at least five potentially life-threatening conditions. These don't all kill you all the time, but they are potentially life-threatening. And so this is going to be cases. We're going to run through some cases, make some points. I'm going to ask you to look and see what you're seeing. This is a gentleman who's 59, has double vision for 6 weeks. He has high blood pressure that's treated, and he has double vision. That's his chief complaint. And a lot of my patients that I see have double vision. There are things, bad things that can cause double vision, something that are not so bad, but he did have double vision. And here are his eye movements, and you can look at them and say, well, they don't look so bad. And he was noticing double vision when he looked to the right, and he had a very mild right abduction deficit. So this right eye, I can find my, I'm looking for my my pointer here. Usually I can get it, but it's on the, maybe it's only on my screen back there. Well, that didn't work very well. But his right eye is not abducting quite fully. And so when he looks to the right, he's getting a little esotropic. And it was sent to me, and it was thought, well, this is probably related to his high blood pressure. He's really old, 59. I'm 59, so he's 59, and they said, well, this is one of those microvascular, this will get better in 6 weeks, and he got to me sort of for another opinion. And so we talked to him, asked him some other questions. So we always want to know, when you think about differential diagnoses, and you say it's true, one of the most common reasons I see a sixth nerve palsy is it's related to high blood pressure, or diabetes, something like that, but that's the differential of an isolated sixth nerve palsy. So you always want to look for other things going on. And I said, is there anything else going on? And he said, well, not really. And he said, well, you know, it's funny. The last couple of weeks, I've noticed that when I'm eating, I have a little saliva kind of coming down the out of my side of my mouth. And so, indeed, I'm trying to show you that he had very mild weakness on the right side of his face. And indeed, when I checked sensation and said, hey, does it feel just with a cotton tip? Feel about the same? No, not really. It doesn't feel quite as strong on the right. So he had signs not just of a mild right sixth, but a mild right fifth, sixth, and seventh. And that's a whole nother story. He's got three cranial nerves in a row. And whenever you have two or more in a row, you always have to worry about something else going on. Something maybe compressing the nerves, or maybe a stroke. He's 59. So we ordered an MRI. And the MRI, it's just to make sure we make that anatomic point. This is a cross-section through the pons, and what you're seeing here are where the fifth, sixth, and seventh cranial nerves start, right in the pons, in the brain stem. So a small lesion could potentially cause these symptoms. And sure enough, a day or two later, we got the MRI. We did not order it urgently under these circumstances. And the radiologist called me and he said, yep, he said, we found the problem. He's got this little, looks like maybe a little stroke. There's a little abnormal signal in the pons. He said, you're right there in the left pons. And I said, I saw him a couple days ago, but I'm pretty sure the findings were on the right. And the radiologist said, no, it's on the left. And so you can see the red arrow, that subtle little, he said, maybe this is a little ischemia, a little blood supply problem. And so I said, what neuro-ophthalmologists always say, let me look at the films. Right, one of the definitions of neuro-ophthalmologist is a doctor who makes a diagnosis based on MRIs that were previously read as normal. So we got the films. This was back when we had the actual films, and we put them up. And I put it up on the screen, and my ophthalmic assistant said, wait a minute, what's that? And I said, oh, that's not good. And this was metastatic lung cancer that the radiologist had missed, because they were fixated looking at the pons and the brain stem. And I said two things. One, you sure there's nothing going on the other side? Nope. You sure you labeled the film right? No, they didn't like that. So this actually did kill him eventually. This was how he was diagnosed with lung cancer. He did not know he had lung cancer prior to this double vision, but it wasn't just the double vision, it was the rest of the story. So when someone has double vision, you want to ask them, is there anything else going on? So, next patient, another potentially deadly, she didn't die, another potentially deadly problem. So she is in the emergency room, and she had a motor vehicle accident, a little whiplash, and wants to go home. But the emergency room physician noticed there was, well, what did they notice? Anisocoria, there's a little difference in size of the pupils, yes? So that right pupil's a little smaller than left. Did the emergency room physician notice anything else? Ptosis. So they didn't notice ptosis, but my resident did. So there is a little bit of ptosis on the right. It's not symmetric. So if you're just looking at her, you might say, well, certainly her lid's not really droopy, but there is a little difference from side to side. And what you can do is take your near card with a millimeter ruler on it and just measure the distance from the upper to lower lid, the intrapalpebral fissure, and you'll find that it's about a millimeter, millimeter and a half smaller on the right. So she's got meiosis, a smaller pupil, and ptosis, which means she has a Horner syndrome. So one of the key things you're going to do if you see somebody, this is not her, different patient, but she also had ptosis and meiosis. And so as soon as you see ptosis and meiosis, there's one other quick thing you can do while you're examining the pupils. You can. Of course, you want to see how they react. They both react well, and that's the case with the Horner syndrome. But you simply look at the pupils in the light, and you look at the pupils in the dark. Because in a Horner syndrome, the small pupil won't dilate well. That's what a Horner syndrome is about, right? You're not getting the right innervation to the iris dilator muscle. The normal pupil, when you turn the lights off, gets bigger like it should. So you're going to see more anisocoria in the dark than in the light. And then your level of suspicion for Horner's goes way, way up. So she has a right Horner syndrome as well. And this is just the anatomy. It has to do with the innervation. This is the sympathetic chain. It comes down from the hypothalamus. And as I tell my patients, follows a very funny course. Instead of going from your brain to your eye, right? Nope, it goes down your spinal cord, over your lung, back up your internal carotid artery. And then ultimately, it gets to Mueller's muscle in the upper lid, which is where you get the ptosis. It goes to the iris dilator muscle. So you get a smaller pupil because it's not working like it should, and it goes to a muscle in the lower lid called, anyone know the name of that? My residents don't, Horner's muscle. And so you see meiosis, ptosis, sometimes anhidrosis, that means a problem with sweating on the same side. And what we worry about, especially in patients in the emergency room or anybody who's had any sort of neck injury, even a mild whiplash, is something called a carotid artery dissection. So the idea here is that as blood flows up through that carotid artery, if you get a little bit of a hole in the inner wall of the artery, as that blood rushes through, it gets in and dissects the layers of the wall. And so you see a blood clot in the wall. There's still blood flowing, but what happens when blood gets stagnant? It clots. It can travel downstream to your brain or your eye, but it certainly can cause big problems by doing that. This can be seen on an MRI, and I don't think I can get my laser pointer to work, but you'll see, I can't rush over from side to side, but there's a little crescent right over here. That's blood in the wall of the carotid artery. So that's a cross section through the artery, and that white crescent is blood in the wall that's clotted. And so just from an MRI, you can make the diagnosis. You usually do want to order an MRA or a CTA to specifically look at the blood vessels. And the problem with this is that those emboli, those clots that travel through the bloodstream, called emboli, can affect cranial nerves, they can affect your retinal blood supply, they can affect your brain, causing percentage of people, they can affect, they can kill you. So that's not that common, thankfully. But people like this in the emergency room, this is an urgent situation. If you see somebody in clinic, well, yesterday I was coughing a lot, or I fell and hit my head, and now my lid's droopy, or my pupils are different size, they need to go to the emergency room for vascular imaging, to rule out a dissection. If they have one, they need to be anticoagulated. It's the first hours to days to a week that's the crucial time. So this is an emergency. And the other thing that at least medical students always hear about is something called the Pancoast tumor. So here's a tumor you can see in the top of the lung. And this can actually present with just a Werner syndrome. So this is lung cancer that is catching that nerve as it comes down the brainstem, across the top of the lung and back up the internal carotid artery. So you can, not that often, I've seen maybe a few in my career, but when patients say, oh, I have to have an MRI for this, my lid's a little droopy and I didn't even notice the pupil thing. I said, what, how bad could this be? Lung cancer. Oh, okay, that shuts them up. Now, that said, most people with Horner syndromes, it's not going to be something deadly. So it's not, oh my gosh, it's a Horner's, you're going to die. There are a lot of other things. In fact, this is a paper we wrote a few years ago. We had 200 patients with Horner syndromes, and two-thirds was idiopathic, which meant we couldn't find an answer. And so it's sort of what you see is what you get. And really, about 85% of the people had very benign things that were not going to kill them. But one of the reasons I see a lot of patients is the referring doctors say, this could kill you. This could be a tumor or an aneurysm or whatever. You would need to see neuro-ophthalmology. So, Werner syndrome. And in the first case, cancer, metastatic cancer. So this is a 63-year-old gentleman who notes a droopy lid for the last couple of weeks. He's also had a little bit of double vision. And you're watching a video, it just started again, and he's going to be asked to look up. And he's looking up at my finger. Sometimes he's like, how long do you make him look up? Till my arm gets tired. But this is not edited, that's real time. And you can see what's happening. He looks up. Initially, there's a little bit of ptosis. But as he's looking up, that right eyelid gradually comes down. So we call that fatigability. And we think he has what condition? Myasthenia gravis. So this would be classic lid fatigability in myasthenia gravis. Can that kill you? Usually not. So there are a bunch of different eyelid signs we look for. We look for ptosis. We look for variability. We look for fatigability. We look for something called the Kogan's lid twitch sign. I'm going to show that in a second. And then anytime I see a patient who's got a droopy lid or droopy lids, I always check their orbicularis strength. Because if the most common reason of a droopy lid is you're getting more mature, the lids are just it's a mechanical thing, your muscle is shifted a little bit. Well, if that's the case, your orbicularis strength should be fine. Right? So when you tell them, close your eyes tight, and sometimes I say, close your eyes, they'll do this. No, tight, really tight, tight, look at me, like this. Oh, okay. And then if you can fairly easily overcome that, that's not normal. And if you see the combination of ptosis and orbicularis weakness, it's probably myasthenia. And the other thing you look for, I mentioned the Kogan's lid twitch. So look at her left upper lid. She's just looking straight ahead. Oh, sorry, we're looking at her eye movements. But I'm going to zoom in on that left lid, and what you'll see is some little twitching of that lid. Keep watching. Oh, see that? That's a Kogan's lid twitch. Oh, again, just a little bit of a twitch like that, something that you can easily look for in patients with ptosis. If you see it, again, level of suspicion should go way up for myasthenia gravis. And you can do testing in the office. So the sleep or rest test was described many years ago. Now, basically, this condition is fatigable. So patients will often say, yeah, when I wake up, I'm pretty good. But then later in the morning or later in the day, not so good. More drooping, more double vision. So you can do a 30-minute sleep or rest test. You simply have them take a picture, document what their lids look like. Okay, close your eyes. You don't have to go to sleep. But leave them closed. Don't open them. And when I come back, I'm going to tell you to open your lids. Blink once and just relax. Don't do this. Look straight ahead. We'll take another picture. And so here's an example of a positive sleep or rest test. So you can see after 30 minutes of rest. The problem is, who's got 30 minutes? Right? That's a long time. But you can do a rest test. The other thing you can do is an ice test. Anybody heard of ice testing? Okay. Good. So this is a 2-minute ice application. So the lid has to be droopy and you simply have them take a picture, put the ice pack on for 2 minutes. Oftentimes patients say, oh, it's cold. And I say, well, I've got an injection I can give you, but it might stop your heart. And then they shut up. And you only need to see about a millimeter of improvement to say, this is myasthenia. So here we go. Look at the left upper. See how droopy that was? Sorry, I didn't show it to you. So here we go. 2 minutes is going to elapse. She's going to take the ice pack, and that's a rubber glove with ice in it. And she's going to look straight ahead, blink once. Boom. So a very positive ice test. That won't last for long. You can't say, okay, take it off. I'll go get the doctor. And then, you know, 30 seconds later, the lid's going to start to come right back down because the lid's going to heat right back up. Nowadays, my technician, who's worked with me for a while, both of them, they'll leave an ice pack in the room after they check in the patient because they say, I think this one's got myasthenia. They love it when they're right. But they'll actually leave the ice pack right in the room on the counter. So I walk in the room and I guess she's got myasthenia. So the problem with myasthenia, although it certainly can just be ocular myasthenia, and most of the patients I see are isolated ocular myasthenia, a fair percent, it can become generalized, which means that any muscle in the body can be affected. Chewing, swallowing, breathing. So when people say, well, what's the worst case scenario? Well, if you're on a desert island and you couldn't be treated and it affected your diaphragm, you could suffocate and die. And before we had treatments, you know, decades ago, a percentage of people did die from respiratory crisis. And I've had at least a couple people that presented with droopy lid, double vision, treated, did okay, but then some years later called and said, well, a little short of breath, and then my doctor thinks it's a cold. And I said, no, go to the emergency room, get it checked out. And at least a couple have been on respirators for a few days while they treated them and reversed it. So unlikely to kill you these days. Okay, so myasthenia, potentially deadly. Nowadays, hopefully not deadly. 32-year-old woman, vision loss, left eye, pain around the eye, healthy individual. She's got good vision in the right eye, but count fingers in the left eye. There's a left relative afferent pupillary defect. Feels her full of confrontation in the right eye. Fundus is normal, so my resident saw the patient and said, oh, this sounds like optic neuritis, right? Young, healthy, pain, decreased vision, relative afferent pupillary defect. The fundus was normal. There was no swelling, but two-thirds of patients with optic neuritis have retrobulbar optic neuritis. There's no disc swelling. The old saying is, the patient sees nothing, the doctor sees nothing, except for the relative afferent pupillary defect. So that may be your responsibility to catch the relative afferent pupillary defect if you're dilating patients for your doc. And I said, well, wait a minute. That's the story. What about the formal visual field testing? And he said, oh, yeah, I did get that. It was pretty good, but, of course, they didn't do the other eye because it was count fingers. So this is the normal 20/20 asymptomatic eye. And so they said, yeah, the field, it's not bad, but it's not quite normal. And I said, well, text it to me so I can see it on my phone, and this is what it looked like. And the question is, does this change our way of thinking? Is this optic neuritis? Do we blow this field defect off? You'd never catch this by confrontation. And so it's the right eye, so this would be supratemporal field defect. And the answer is, when you see someone who's got bad vision in one eye and a temporal defect in the other eye, the question is, where is one lesion that could do that? So we know that the left optic nerve is not working very well. And we know there's a little temporal field defect in the other eye. So if there were a lesion back here near the chiasm, if you think of my body as the chiasm, and you catch some of those crossing fibers that serve the temporal field of vision, you could see bad vision in one eye and just a temporal defect in the other, very mild. And I said, this is a whole different story. This is usually a compressive problem. This is usually a tumor. This is usually not optic neuritis. And here was her tumor. And I'm going to try one more time. Usually I can get my laser pointer to find that, but it is not. So, sorry, you'll have to look over here. Here's the tumor. Here's the chiasm. Here's the tumor. This is a big pituitary tumor, but pituitary tumors don't usually kill you. But this one had bled, and that's why the symptoms were sudden. Typically, these tumors are very slow. They're painless. But she came in with sudden change. So what happened was there was a tumor that we didn't know about, and then it bled and suddenly got bigger. So she suddenly lost vision. And when pituitary tumors bleed suddenly, they cause headaches and pain. So it really looked like optic neuritis until you looked at all the information and then got the scan. And so the problem is right at the junction of the left optic nerve and the chiasm. So the nerve is being pushed on completely, terrible vision, you're catching the crossing fibers. And this is all, and there's the tumors. Okay. And so this is called pituitary apoplexy. And that just means there's bleeding into pituitary tumor. And this is an emergency. I see lots of pituitary tumors, run-of-the-mill pituitary tumors, never an emergency. Sometimes we don't even operate. We follow them for 20 years and they don't change. But when they bleed, they can cause lots of other problems. And it is an emergency. So they're going to have pain almost all the time, headache, pain in or around the eyes, nausea, vomiting, ophthalmoplegia, because right on the other, on either side of the tumor are your cavernous sinuses and those third and fourth and sixth cranial nerves that we talked a little bit about. You can have visual loss like our patient did, and all sorts of problems with hormones because your pituitary gland regulates those things. And that's really why it becomes a problem. You can get a problem with the adrenal system. You get low sodium in the blood. You can then get low blood pressure, and you can die from hemodynamic shock. So this is an emergency. This is not, oh, another optic neuritis, get an MRI in a week, we'll see you in 4 weeks, you'll be better. This is something that could kill you. Yes? On an OCT? No, you would not see anything on an OCT. As long as the nerves are not swollen, you possibly could see some swelling of the nerve. That would be very unlikely. But no, you wouldn't at this point. Now, if there's permanent damage to the visual system, which there was, you would ultimately lose axons, and you would see that on an OCT. But acutely, nope. So the treatment is stabilize their hemodynamic system, make sure they're not in shock, make sure they've got enough blood volume to survive, replace the hormones. Obviously, I'm not doing this. I'm sending this person to the emergency room, and the ER docs and the endocrinologists are going to work on this patient for me. So outcome with treatment, mortality is nearly zero, not quite zero. And usually things get better. Now the exception is patients with vision loss, sometimes that rapid expansion can cause some permanent damage to the visual system. So you want to do what you can do, but usually these people are going to, anybody with vision loss is going to have sort of urgent surgery to decompress the visual system and hopefully prevent permanent loss of vision. All right, last topic. So this is a woman in her 50s, high blood pressure, under pretty good control. She was referred to me with right upper eyelid ptosis. She denied double vision until I looked at her eye movements and I said, follow my finger up, and she looked up at my finger and said, oh, now it's double. So she didn't have any symptoms of double vision, but when I was looking at her eye movements, indeed, her right eye did not quite move up as high as her left eye. So as she began to look upwards, the right eye lagged behind, and she developed a hypotropia on the right, hypertropia on the left. So now she has a little droopy lid, and she has a deficit in elevation, a mild deficit in elevation of the eye. She's not having any pain. This has been going on now for about 8 days, not changed much. And really, she's just here because her lid's droopy. Anybody have any concerns about this? Or third nerve. So maybe this could be a very early third nerve palsy, right? You're used to seeing third nerve palsy. The lid is shut. The eye does not move up or down or in. But if something is just starting to push on that nerve, maybe all you get is this. So you might just see a very mild third nerve palsy. And the worry about third nerve palsies is that the third nerve lives right next to a blood vessel, the origin of the posterior communicating artery, and that's where aneurysms like to form. And on the MRA, on the right, there is the aneurysm. Sorry, people on the other side of the room. There's an aneurysm right up there, and that aneurysm, you can imagine, if the aneurysm forms right where that artery forms, one of the first things it might do is hit that third nerve. And if it does, a little bit, maybe you'll see what I was seeing there. If it does it a lot, the eyelid will shut, and when you open the lid, the eye won't move up or down or in. So it was a Friday morning, and I'll show her again. It's a Friday morning, and I called the MRI place and said, listen, I said, it's Friday morning, I don't know. She has no pain, this is really mild, but I'd feel better if we could get an MRI and an MRA today. And they said, oh, no problem. So I sent her away, I saw patients all day. About 5 o'clock, I got a phone call, and it was from them. And I said, okay, what's going on? They said, oh, she's really claustrophobic. So we're going to have her come back Monday with anesthesia. Right? And I said, okay. So I said, she's there. I said, yeah. So, okay, ma'am, Let me know if there's anything going on over the weekend, you know, any headache or anything like that, let me know. And so Monday rolled around, and we called the MRI place to get the results, and they said, oh, well, she didn't show up. I said, oh, okay. So we called the house, and the story was that on Sunday morning, she got a bad headache. She went to the emergency room, and she died. And so that was one of my worst cases ever, because I thought, well, I guess I should have said, no, you can't ever come back Monday. She needs the MRI, MRA now. We could have maybe have admitted her to the hospital. I will tell you that neurosurgeons look at aneurysms a little bit differently. I mean, if we had found the aneurysm, I think what they would have done was they would have admitted her, hydrated her, watched her, and planned for surgery Monday, because that's a big surgical procedure. They want their team of experts that do the neurosurgery. But I've definitely found patients with aneurysms causing more of a problem than this. I send them, oh my gosh, there's an aneurysm, and they say, oh yeah, okay, have them come in, we'll get start an IV, and we'll do surgery in, you know, a day or two. So I'm not sure it would have been a different outcome, that's at least what I tell myself, but that's what happened. So in this case, she did die from it. So in summary, even subtle ophthalmic findings may be the first sign of potentially life-threatening conditions. You need to pay close attention to the pupils, to the eye movements, and of course visual loss with headache because of this pituitary apoplexy. And I thank you for your attention.